Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you're listening to Total EM. We are back with a rather controversial subject this time. At least I suspect this will be a controversial subject, because we're going to talk about dual sequential defibrillation or double sequential defibrillation. Either one is appropriate. They carry both the same point across. And if you are an avid FOMED listener, free and open access medical education listener or follower, post reader, blogger, whatever, you have most likely heard of this before, and somehow if you have not, we're going to talk about a little bit here, but I would highly encourage you to look at some other posts that maybe go into some other details about this as well. But I do know that some people do just listen to this or maybe only visit one or two other places, so it may not have been discussed as much, but I am a big consumer of FOMED, which is free and open access medical education, so I love this stuff. And this has been around for a couple of years. About the same time that I started podcasting was when this first started hitting hard. And to be fair, there is a little bit of evidence out there to discuss the role of dual sequential defibrillation, but there is also some evidence to go against this. And this topic made me think of Jeff Goldblum's line from Jurassic Park, where he said, "Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should." And that is a little bit of what I want to bring here, because, I mean, that's ultimately what comes to the source of this. It's not whether or not we can physically do dual sequential defibrillation. It's more about, should we do this measure? And we're going to abbreviate this to DSD. That could be another appropriate use, and that helps avoid the dual or double or anything like that, but it doesn't matter. What I want this podcast to be is not the definite yes or no, because I don't think we're there yet in either direction, but to at least give us some pause, because I admit, when I first heard this, I thought this was a great idea. This was something that was clever, but that was before really thinking about some of the issues that come up, which we're going to save for the end of this discussion. I do want to remind people, just because it is getting to that time of year and we need the registrations, that please, before it's too late, make sure that if you're interested in Yes, I Scan, to go and register for that. And this is part of the AAPA National Conference, and it's not just Yes, I Scan for students. There is this year now several paid workshops. These are cheap workshops. Doesn't mean cheap in its quality, but just low in its price. And we have great instructors coming from all over the country willing to teach you. And I only bring that up real quick because we are getting to the point where we need people to register. We've had lots of great registrations so far. But if you do not do that soon, whether you're a student or going to be a paid person in those paid workshops, get on it right away. Okay, back off of that. I just want to make sure I plug that before I forgot. But what exactly is dual sequential defibrillation? I've talked about this now for several minutes, but I really haven't defined what we're talking about. Well, let's think about this cardiac arrest patient. So they are in refractory ventricular fibrillation usually, you know, and sometimes there may be a ventricular tachycardia, but most of the time this is refractory VF. And so this patient, we've tried shocking with our usual route. We've done our medications. Whether or not that's beneficial is its own separate story, but we've talked about that a little bit before. But, you know, we're doing our high-quality chest compressions. We're doing our defibrillations, and it's just not cutting it. Let's say we start, like in my shop, usually we do the anterior-posterior approach, but I notice a lot of times in EMS, they're doing the anterior-lateral approach. Either is acceptable. But a lot of times what's coming across is that, okay, let's say it's coming in by EMS and they're doing the anterior and lateral approach. So they have right upper, left lower. That's the way I traditionally learned it. It's a nice placement. It can work well for some patients, but for some reason it's not working. Okay, so some of the advocates out there who suggest that we use dual sequential defibrillation is going to say, you try the initial approach, that anterior and lateral approach, or it can be anterior, posterior, it doesn't matter. But you try that first approach three times. If they are still in refractory ventricular fibrillation, you're going to add a different set of pads. That doesn't mean you take off the old set unless you're worried about it not functioning correctly. But you keep the original set there. And now, let's say if you're doing the anterior lateral, you're going to add a second set of anterior posterior pads. It doesn't have to be that way. You can put them side by side or stuff like that. And there's a couple of different ways to do it. And we've included that in the show notes too. But most commonly, the way I've been seeing this done is you have an anterior lateral and then you have an anterior posterior, which I think makes sense because of the angles of our current and trying to hit as much myocardium as possible, because that idea is that the more myocardium we hit, ideally, possibly about 95% is at least how one person described it to me, that if we can capture as much of the myocardium as possible, then we can potentially, and I say potentially, be able to defibrillate a person when we couldn't originally. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So we do the anterior lateral. Three shocks, doesn't work. Now we add the anterior posterior pads. We tried this for a couple of shocks. Okay, we've gone through five defibrillations. No success. They're still in refractory VF. Okay, now is when you do that dual sequential defibrillation. You don't have to do it this way. You can throw the second set on and go right on it. But the thing is that we really don't have a study that's saying how many times to do it, when we do it, to what amount, stuff like that. But the general concept is we have two different sets of pads and we shock the maximum amount, which if you're talking about biphasic, it's going to be that 200 joules times two, so 400 joules total. If that's the monophasic, you're talking about two sets of 360, so 720 joules total. And that is basically what we do. Okay, that doesn't sound too bad, right? I mean, the hard part is you're going to need a second set of pads and a second defibrillator, which can be tricky in the pre-hospital environment, which is where most of these studies come from, or case studies or whatever, is that they're going to have a second truck, which in of itself is not always a challenge depending on where you're located at. And in at least one of these studies where it's in London, I've worked in London, I've done the pre-hospital side of London, which is really cool. I enjoyed it, but you can get another ambulance. That's not too big of a deal. But in your more rural environments where that next ambulance could be 15, 20, 30, maybe even 60 minutes away, okay, this is something that's not realistically going to happen. And so for these people, it may be strictly off the table. Then again, you may be the only ambulance in the area and you may be going en route, which also has the inherent dangers of taking a cardiac arrest patient en route. Not that I'm saying you can never do it. There's obviously some roles for it. There's been some discussion on this previously with other podcasts such as MCRIT, where they had a great discussion on this. But that's a whole separate debate. Let's just say for the sake of argument, we have two defibrillators, we have two sets of pads. We can do this where we're at, no matter where we're at. In the hospital, in the pre-hospital setting, it does not matter. The point is that we have the equipment there. But should we do it? Well, if you at least listen to the likes of other podcasters, which is part of the reason why I haven't done this yet, is because it was covered so much before, but I don't think a lot of people have talked about some of the negatives to this. It's that, yeah, you should try this. This is definitely like a quote-unquote last-ditch effort. But I think the problem has become is that fewer and fewer people are saying last-ditch effort, meaning like we've thrown everything else at it, we've tried everything else we know to do, and now we're doing this because this is all we have left. And instead, pushing it earlier and earlier. Five shocks, that's pretty early in some systems. Those patients may just now be getting to the hospital if they're out of hospital arrest for me and my patient population demographic area. But in other places, this could be very feasible. And what we're talking about here is maybe there are some other things you can do first. There's some evidence that esmolol could be beneficial with refractory ventricular fibrillation. And so maybe this is something we need to at least consider. That, again, its own little separate discussion. I've included some stuff in the show notes that talks about that role. And at least with that one, it doesn't have the potential negative effects that happen both downstream financially and for patients that we have to worry about. So then, let's talk a little bit about the evidence. There have been some case reports and some case series, which is where all the interest was generated from. And we're like, yes, when you do this, patients got ROSC with neurologically intact survivals. Awesome. Good news. Yay. Right? These are good things. This is what we want to hear. However, and I do mean however, There have been some newer studies coming out of Resuscitation, that's particular journal, which is why I want you to pay attention to this part for a second. There was a retrospective case study in 2016, and then another in 2017, and then a meta-analysis of those two studies in 2018. So in the last few years, we've been having some new data. And it's a retrospective case study, which is not super high in the evidence, but this retrospective study is at least better than what we've had in the past, where it's just individual case reports or case series. And we are going to be able to at least look at several patients at a time. In one group, it's 50, another group, it's 45. But the point is that in these patients, the ones who got dual sequential defibrillation did not have a significant improvement in survival. Specifically, the Ross et al. 2016 study, the dual sequential defibrillation group had a neurologically intact survival of 6%, and in the standard defibrillation group, had a neurologically intact survival of 11.4%. Now, you could say that bystander CPR was less in the DSD group of 30% versus 45% in the standard defibrillation. And you could also say that the witness arrest was less common in the dual sequential defibrillation group of 38% versus 54.6% in the standard defibrillation cohort. I understand those counter arguments, but I don't think it's enough to say that, hey, this is good enough to argue the data, especially when we have a second study that was focused in London by Emerson et al., which demonstrated similar findings. And then they took a meta-analysis of that data and again showed the negative findings. Okay, a little bit of something there, but still, there's some at least evidence of it. I would challenge you, though, that case studies and case reports get me a little nervous because we're much more biased to report the good of what happens versus the negative. So if I have someone who survives and I did some unique heroic therapy, yeah, I'll probably write an article about that. If I have a unique heroic therapy I tried that didn't work and the patient died, I would probably be less likely to report that. And then when we add in, when I did something that broke my equipment, I'm probably not going to tout that in the literature unless that was a treatment where it was something that was previously recommended or at least suggested by other research, which is where this comes in. And this gets a little more interesting in my book because there was a little bit of evidence that came from the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2017, which talks about a situation just like this. So they did dual sequential defibrillation, and they had two defibrillators going at the same time. And what they found out is after they used it, they caused damage to at least one of the machines, which was specifically a LifePak. They did also have Zoles in this little study that they had going on. But what they found out was that this does have risk. It is worth noting that this is an off-label procedure for defibrillators. Defibrillators were not designed and nor are FDA approved to do dual sequential defibrillation. They're designed to do their role to defibrillate, but they're not designed to do the dual sequential defibrillation. And the reason why that's important is because when you use a device outside of its approved fashion, if something happens to it, they don't have to replace it. They don't have to fix it. It's not covered under the warranty. In fact, LifePak says, and I'm going to quote this, quote, LifePak defibrillators comply with standards which require defibrillators to withstand defibrillation shocks from a second defibrillator connected to a patient. This testing does not include delivering simultaneous sequential or overlapping 360 joule defibrillation shocks from two LifePak defibrillators. There are no design and/or safety standards for use of external defibrillators to perform double sequential defibrillation. We cannot guarantee the reliability of functionality of devices subject to this off-label use. Product warranty cannot legally cover damage to LifePak defibrillators, which occurs as a result of performing an off-label use, end quote. The reason why this matters is because this may financially cost us, maybe not us personally, but it could cost our department, and it has downstream implications. What happens when we don't catch that that has failed or that has become damaged, and we have the next cardiac arrest patient that comes in before the routine testing of that device to make sure it's still working, and now we have a patient that would fail to receive the benefits of early defibrillation. We know that early defibrillation has a number needed to treat of just 5 for neurologically intact survival, which is why it's so important for us to have early defibrillation. So all I can picture is this ambulance that tried this technique, and maybe it did or did not work, but in the end, that defibrillator becomes non-functional. Next call rolls around, that patient that needs that defibrillator, it's not going to work for them. So what happens? They have a negative outcome as a result. Or let's say maybe the crew was very preemptive. They caught it. They realized that there was a problem because they knew that this could come up. Okay, so they find that their defibrillator is now non-functioning. What happens? Well, most of the time, you don't have extra defibrillators lying around, at least not where I'm at. So if you're in this rural setting where each truck only has one and there's not a backup around and it's going to take some time before you can get a backup, that ambulance is now out of service. Because most likely, you're not going to run a call where you do not have this available. So this is something that we have to consider. Maybe in a hospital setting, this is a little different because usually there are multiple crash carts, which means there are multiple defibrillators, which means that we at least have a backup option. But we have to keep in mind, we have now lost an important resource, something that we could have used for other patients. So it has cost time. It has potentially increased the risk to our patients should it fail. And it's not something that these pieces of equipment were ever designed to do. Not that they may not be able to do it, because obviously there's a good amount of evidence that other times they've tried it and it's worked, and that's great. But I really think we need to stress that if you're going to do this, which again, there are certain reasons and certain times that you can. I'm not saying you can never do this, but there are at least times when we need to pause before we do this. Maybe we try the other things first, like the esmolol or changing pad placement by itself before we just go and dive into something that sounds really cool, which is my ultimate point with this. It's not that I don't want you to do it. It's that I at least want you to think about it first. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.